Thank you. Well, above, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to participate in this beautiful workshop. Well, and the main results of we obtained jointly with my student Lena Karpel. In fact, my talk will be distinctly divided in two parts. The first part is just an introductory to the subject, and I will focus on mostly on Bernoulli measures and explaining which of them are homeomorphic. And the second part will be about new results. I will consider measures which are determined on stationary Bradley diagrams, and we also answer the question about homeomorphism of such measures. So this is the plan of my talk. First of all, as I said, I will try to explain why this type of problems is interesting and how it's related to dynamics. Then I will explain the material on the example of Bernoulli measures. In the this context, we will define general properties of measures on Cantor sets. I mean the so-called good and refinable measures. And it turns out that this is related to dynamics. And later we will discuss the notion of Bradley diagrams, and I will show how measures on Bradley diagrams can be defined. And my main results will be just about these measures. We will classify them with respect to homeomorphism. So the main definition is the following. We have a topological space, we have two measures, Borel probability measures, and we say that they are homeomorphic or topologically equivalent if there exists a homeomorphism which sends one measure onto the other one. Well, this is of course an equivalence relation on the set of measures, and I will use the following notations for the group of all homeomorphisms and for the set of Borel probability measures. And as soon as we have an equivalence relation, it's just natural to answer the following problems. The first one is how we can classify these measures with respect to the introduced equivalence relation. In such a form, it's meaningless because this set M of Y is too large to answer this question. So it's more natural if you take subclasses of measures, and we will try to find out which measures in this subclass are equivalent. And the other question is the following. You fix a measure, and you answer the question about the class of all measures which are homeomorphic to the chosen one measure. Okay. This result is well known as maybe classical result of Oxtobi and Tulum, which was proved many years ago. This related to the class of measures which are homeomorphic to the Lebesgue measure on the n-dimensional cube. So very mild conditions. The first one is that measure must be non-atomic. The other condition says that the measure must be full. This means that the measure of every open set must be positive. And one more condition is that the boundary of this cube must be zero measure. Under these conditions, the measure is homeomorphic to the Lebesgue measure. So if you have two such measures satisfying the condition of the theorem, they are homeomorphic. So in other words, we describe the class of measures which are homeomorphic to the Lebesgue one, Lebesgue measure. Later, Oxtobi and Prasad extended this result to the Hilbert cube, and there are plenty of similar results about measures about generosity of transformations in the nice book by Alpern and Prasad. Well, and it turns out that these problems are related to the connectedness of the space. You see that in the case of n-dimensional cube, very mild conditions allowed us to find homeomorphic measures. It's surprisingly, but in the Cantor set, Oxford-Ulam theorem does not work. And Aiken was the first who initiated the systematic study of homeomorphisms on homeomorphic measures on a Cantor set. And most results I will mention later, just due to Aiken and his colleagues. This one is contained in the book by Alpern and Prasad. They considered manifolds and with boundaries, without boundaries. Okay, so of course, this, if I want to motivate this study, first of all, I would mention that this problem is interesting in itself because we are interested in classification problems. And the other point is the following: this type of problems is related to orbit equivalence. This is the definition of orbit equivalence, and it was mentioned today. So if you have two homeomorphisms of a Cantor set, then they are orbit equivalent if there exists a homeomorphism again of these sets which sends orbits of one of them onto the orbits of the other one. There is a nice result by Giordano, Putnam, and Scow. They proved that the notion of orbit equivalence can be recognized in terms of measures. They proved that two minimal homeomorphisms, are orbit equivalent if there exists if and only if there exists a homeomorphism of between these two spaces that sends invariant measures onto the set of invariant, the simplest of invariant measures onto the simplest of invariant measure for the other homeomorphism. Well, and so we see that in this case we naturally come to the situation when we have to map measures from one space onto the measures from the other one by a homeomorphism. And it's, in other words, we have homeomorphic measures. And if I want to generalize this approach to aperiodic homeomorphism, I have a lot of difficulties. And the first one is, of course, we have to find out which measures could be homeomorphic. In general, this problem is open for aperiodic transformations, and I will say a little bit later some partial results on this. Okay, and now, as I promised, I want to come to Bernoulli trial measures. This is well known, of course. We have the set of sequences, 0-1 sequences. We have the product measure, and this measure is defined exactly by one number, the measure of say 1. This is R. And the very old and classical results about homeomorphic measures is the following. It was proved by Navarro, Bermudez, and Juan. There are two statements in this in the theorem I want to discuss. The first one is a little bit disappointing. What I mean, if you have R, which is either rational or transcendental or an algebraic integer, that this class is just trivial, the class of homeomorphic measures. You see, it contains only, formally two, but in fact it's just the same measure with respect to symmetry map. And the second statement, of course, follows from the first one. But the important fact is that each class is at most countable if you stay in the set of Bernoulli measures. We're just saying about Bernoulli measures. Well, a little surprising is that these two measures, mu 1/2 and mu 1/4, are not homeomorphic, because if you just try to compare the values of this measure, you will see that it's almost the same values of this measure on cylinder sets. Well, and Oxtorde and Navarro and Bermudez actually showed that this notion, I mean the notion of homeomorphic measures, is not trivial. They found an example of a measure which the class of which consists of at least four measures. So this is determined by the root of this equation. This is number t, and they show that t and t, measure defined by t and t square are equivalent, topologically equivalent or homeomorphic. Actually, it's unknown if this is the only measures in this class. Maybe this class consists more measures. It's still a question. So, and motivated by these results, the following problem is an open problem, is formulated in the following way. We take arbitrary R between 0 and 1, and we consider the class of measures which are homeomorphic to mu R. And is this class finite or not? One should expect that this is finite, and I want to confirm this point of view because of the following result. Jinks 2 years ago showed that if R is an algebraic integer, then this class is finite. There are only finitely many Bernoulli measures which are homeomorphic to mu R. On the other hand, Dougherty, Molding, and Jinks showed that this class can be arbitrarily large. They show that for every n, one can find an algebraic integer such that this class is greater than n by cardinality. well, and in the paper by Jingst, one can find conditions which formally answer the question about which measures, which Bernoulli measures are homeomorphic. This conditions given in the form of necessary and sufficient conditions for some polynomials. Actually, they are checkable, but it takes, of course, efforts to check if these conditions work. Well, and almost nothing is known if we take Bernoulli measures defined on the spaces with more states than two. Well, this is about Bernoulli measures. And now, what is behind of this theorem? When we deal with a Cantor set, of course, we remember that there are countably many Clopin subsets, and they are very important from many points of view, from the point of view of topology, and in particular for measures. It turns out that every measure is completely determined by the values on the Clopin sets. That's why we consider the Clopin value set of every measure by taking just the values on Clopin sets. This set is obviously invariant with respect to a homeomorphism. Actually, I don't know who is responsible for this.
Kind of terminology absolutely not necessary.
Well, but the whole system. Okay, it's closed and open, but well, actually it's of course like... yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let me use this term because I... So, so the set S of mu is an invariant of the homeomorphism. That's easy checkable. And of course, this is a natural question if this one is a complete invariant. Unfortunately, this is not the case. And to see the non-triviality of the situation with measures on a Cantor set, Aiken gave the following example. He found an uncounted subset in the set of all measures, such that if two measures are from this set are homeomorphic, then they must be the same, and this homeomorphism must be identity. In other words, this, if you take this set and consider the intersection of this set with orbits, with equivalence relation defined by homeomorphism, we have just one point in this intersection for every class. So, as I said, that the set S of mu is not complete invariant. To see this, one can compare two measures. Again, they are Bernoulli measures. One of them is defined on three-state three-state space. I mean, just uniform measure one-third, 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 and the other is defined on two points product one-third and two-third. You see that this set is the same, but these two measures are not homeomorphic, and the reason for this is will be explained a little bit later, because they have different inner structure. Well, Aiken defined a very important class of measures. Perhaps you don't like the name for this class. Well, but it's again not my responsibility. I just follow Aiken. Well, so the measure is good if the following condition holds. If you take two, sorry, Klopen sets, and one of them is greater in measure than the other one, then in bigger set we can find a subset, again a Klopen subset, which has the measure of the first one, or the smaller one. In some sort, this is a kind of uniform distributed, well, the values of the measure are just uniformly distributed in every Klopen set. And the following two results explain why this class is so important. For good measures, S of mu indeed is a complete invariant for homeomorphism. Now the situation is much simpler. You just, if you know that the measures are good, you compute S of mu, and if this is the same, you are done. You conclude that the measures are homeomorphic. On the other hand, good measures appear in dynamics. It was shown by Glasner and Weiss that every invariant measure of minimal homeomorphism is good, and Aiken proved the converse statement, that all good measures appear as invariant, even uniquely ergodic measures for a minimal homeomorphism. Well, and now let's look at this set S of mu. We can now study the set from different point of view. First of all, let's find out if this one has a group structure. We will call a set, a subset S of a unit interval, group-like, if this set is obtained at the intersection of additive group with the unit interval. And for good measures, the set S of mu is group-like. It's not hard to verify. That's why this class is natural. Well, a little bit later, Dougherty, Molden, and Yinst found another condition, which is which refines the notion of good condition, and maybe this one is the name is for this measure is refinable. So this condition says the following: you have a Clopen set, and suppose you know that the measure of this Clopen set can be found by the following way. You just take some other Clopen set, and you take this sum, and it turns out that this sum is just the measure of U. If you can now partition U in the Clopen sets with this condition, then the measure is called refinable. So actually, this means that this is, of course, stronger than the notion of good measure. And nevertheless, we will see that in some cases, they are, these conditions are equivalent. Well, the second is about weak refinability. It's two conditions. First of all, the whole space is refinable, and every Clopen set can be partitioned into necessarily finitely many refinable Clopen sets. So that's not hard to see that this condition holds. And what is about the inverse implications? It is unknown if weak refinability is equivalent to refinability. That's a question. And I'm not asking about equivalence, goodness, and refinability, because it's known that refinability does not imply goodness. So, and the following theorem proved by Aitken, Dougherty, Molden, and Yinst of crucial importance, because now we can consider instead of good measures even weakly refinable measures, and if it turns out that the Clopen value sets are the same, then these measures are homeomorphic. Okay, so this is the first part of my talk. And the second is, as I told about Bratteli diagrams and measures on Bratteli diagrams. Well, I will give the definition of the Bratteli diagram, because I suppose it's necessary to do. And I don't need the whole machinery of Bratteli diagram. That's why we will just sketch this definition, and I will give only the main notions. So first of all, what is the Bratteli diagram? This is a graph. Well, let me show how it looks like. This is the diagram, which is considered as a graph directed downward. We have the top, we have levels. At every level, we have a number of vertices, and we have edges between the consecutive levels. What is important for this diagram, this just repeats itself. You see, that is the so-called stationary diagram, because every consecutive sets of edges are the same. Okay, and every diagram is determined by the incidence matrix. No, actually, in the case of stationary diagrams, it's enough to work with matrices, because how this matrix can be determined? You fix, we'll say, the vertex here, and this vertex determines the first row in this incidence matrix. We just take the number of edges to the first, to the second, and to the third vertex, 1, 1, and 0. Now, for example, for the third one, it must be the third row here. We take this vertex, and you see this is 0, 2, and 2 edges leading to the second and the third vertices. and vice versa, if you have a matrix like this, of course you can construct a stationary Bradbury diagram. That's why it's just one-to-one correspondence between these classes. Well, what else? Why stationary diagrams are important? Because this number of results explains why we work with stationary Bradbury diagrams. First, in the case of minimal homeomorphisms, it was shown that every substitution dynamical system, minimal substitution dynamical system, is determined by a Bradbury diagram, by a stationary Bradbury diagram, and conversely, if you have a stationary Bradbury diagram, it determines a substitution dynamical system. And 10 years later, it was shown by myself, Yatkovsky, and Medianets that this can be extended to the class of aperiodic substitution dynamical system. What the difference is between minimal and aperiodic cases? In the case of minimal substitution system, we would have the so-called simple diagram. And look at this one. You see that this one contains two sub-diagrams. This, the first is determined by these two vertices, and the third one is determined here. And these sub-diagrams are simple, because the equivalence relation determined here is minimal. I'll say about this later. And the difference is that there are edges between these two sub-diagrams, and these edges show how this part interacts with this part. Okay, so let me say some formal words about topology on this space. It's clear I will take just the topology generated by cylinder sets, and two paths are close if they agree on a large cylinder set. It must be careful because we work with non-minimal case, so we have to assume that the topology is, or the diagram is chosen in such a way that the path space, XB means stands for the path space, has no isolated points. Formerly, if we don't care of this, it could be some isolated points. Well, and look at this diagram. As I said, there exists exactly one minimal component here, and the other component, which is a simple sum diagram, but if we consider together with these edges, this is not a minimal component of the diagram. Okay, now the equivalence relation. We consider the so-called tail equivalence relation. It's a standard notion for such type of diagrams. So two paths are close if they agree beginning some level I zero. Well, and as I said, the diagram is called simple if this tail equivalence relation is minimal. Okay, and this is just notations for the cylinder set, which is determined by a finite path. So I take E bar just a finite path, and this belongs to this set of finite paths between vertices V naught and V. And the number of such cylinder sets determine actually the number of finite paths which arrives to this vertex W. Okay, and now a measure mu on the path space XB is R invariant by definition if I take two cylinder sets which arrive to the same vertex, and the measures of these two cylinder sets must be the same. Well, dynamically, if you have such sort of a diagram, it means that we have a sequence of partitions of the space into towers. And this means that the invariance of the measure mu means, of course, that the levels of this of these towers are of the same, is the same. Well, and the first result I want to mention, which is related to measures on stationary Bratteli diagrams, was proved together with Kwiatkowski, Medinets, and Solomyak. This result says the following. All measures can be determined in terms of the incidence matrix. No, actually, we work now with the transpose of the incidence matrix A, and we consider this intersection. It's this one is called the core of A, and it turns out that this intersection is a polyhedral core, a polyhedral simplex, and every point of this simplex determines a measure, an R invariant measure. And the ergodic measures correspond exactly to extreme vectors in this core. And some of these measures may be infinite. So for minimal case, of course, it's impossible. All invariant measure must be finite, but for aperiodic transformations, for non-simple diagrams, we have the situation when some ergodic measures are finite and there are or could be infinite measures on the same diagram. Okay, so it's useful to apply the following form. This one is called the Frobenius normal form of matrix. This is another description of the diagram I told before. What this means? Let's look at these blocks. They correspond to primitive matrices which are on the main diagonal, and they correspond to minimal components. And these matrices describe sub-diagrams which are non-minimal components. And these matrices can be zero or non-zero, and at every row it must be at least one non-zero matrix. And for example, if this matrix is non-zero, this means that this sub-diagram interacts with this one, exactly as was shown in the example here. So we have we have only two blocks. This corresponds to the minimal component. This corresponds to non-minimal, and non-zero matrix above the diagonal means that there exists an interaction between this one and this. Okay. And now, if you have this construction, if we have the matrix A given in the Frobenius normal form, we can analytically construct measures, invariant measures. How can we do this? We just compute Perron-Frobenius eigenvalues of these matrices, and some of them have the following property. We call these matrices as distinguished, we call these eigenvalues as distinguished eigenvalues. So if this eigenvalue is greater than any eigenvalue such that this matrix is non-zero, then we call lambda I as a distinguished eigenvalue. In this case, for every distinguished eigenvalue, there exists a non-negative, in this case, of course, this must be a positive vector, eigenvector, and okay, in general, this is non-negative, but this is the coordinate is positive if this vertex is accessible from this matrix. This means that there exists an edge that leads from any vertex from AI to a vertex to the vertex V. Okay, then if you have such a distinguished eigenvalue, so we can easily find the measure of every cylinder set. How we can do it? If I want to compute the measure of the cylinder set which ends in the vertex I. I recall that we work with stationary case. So I take xi, this is exactly the value. Okay, I forgot to say that this vector is considered as a probability vector, so it's uniquely determined. The value of this measure on this cylinder set is just this number. Okay, and having this, we immediately have S of mu, thus by taking the sum of cylinder sets. So this number shows how many cylinder sets we ending at the vertex I we have to take to construct the Kloppen set. Okay, so the case of stationary diagrams allows us to work with Kloppen value set S of mu, and now there are natural questions about good measures, refined measures defined by stationary diagrams. Well, and I would, oops. Well, and let me say that if the measure is non, if the eigenvalue is not distinguished, this means that we have an infinite ergodic measure. But this, okay, I will not work with infinite measures, so let me stop here. So, now, as before, we considered only Bernoulli measures. Now I restrict myself to the case of ergodic probability R invariant measures on the set of stationary Bradley diagrams. Well, and the following questions are natural, and I will answer them. Is the set S of mu group-like? Which measures from this set S are good? And what is the cardinality of this set if we fix a measure mu, and how many measures mu from S are homeomorphic to mu? The first result answers the first question. You see that, roughly speaking, this says that S of mu is always group-like. And this one is the group which is responsible for this property to being group-like. How this group is obtained? We take this vector, and we consider now the group generated by these generators. Well, it turns out that if I multiply by 1 over lambda, I take a bigger group. This is just increasing sequence of subgroups in R. And we prove that S of mu is exactly the intersection of this one and this group and the unit interval. Well, at first glance, it seems that this question is relatively easy, because what you have a set, and you have a set S of mu, and you need to verify if the set is group-like or not. So everyone knows what should we do, but I was surprised when I read in Aiken's paper that the following phrase. He mentioned that the most difficult part always is to prove that S of mu is group-like. Proving this theorem, we are convinced that it's, he was right. In fact, it takes a lot of efforts to show that S of mu is group-like. Let me mention the idea of the proof. Well, first of all, we naturally divide our proof in two cases. When lambda is rational, in other words, this must be, of course, integer, or lambda is an algebraic integer. If this is rational, we work only with rational numbers. The eigenvalue, the eigenvector looks like this, and of course we can assume that these sets are satisfy this condition, relatively prime, then S of mu is obtained in this way. And to see this, we use the asymptotics of growth of these numbers, the height of towers. This asymptotics is like lambda n for i's, which are excessive from the subdiagram, which determines this measure mu. And for other vertices, this growth is smaller than lambda to n. Okay, this case is relatively easy, and let me stop on the other one. If lambda is an algebraic integer, we work with this field. It's convenient to represent every element from this field as a vector with rational coordinates, and we have such a representation. And what happens in this case? We consider this hyperplane, which is determined by this vector n, and this hyperplane, which is just shifted by the vector e1. This is the vector from the standard basis. Well, and if you look closer on the situation, to prove that S of mu is group-like, this is the same as to show that the points that corresponds to S of mu, or the vectors which corresponds to S of mu, are uniformly distributed in this between these two hyperplanes, pi and pi plus e1. And look at this one. If you think of this as a linear combination of vectors, then this one is a matrix which acts on this space. And this matrix is determined by the multiplication by 1 over lambda. This is exactly the same form for S of mu as before, but written in different terms. And now, when we apply this matrix, it turns out that the cone, this one is the cone, the natural cone, is expanding. And finally, limit for the limit position for this cone is exactly the hyperplane pi, and the length of these vectors tends to infinity, and that's why we will see that the situation looks like this: the cone is just expanding, and the vectors which form this cone are growing to infinity, and that this means that finally we cover just the strip between pi and pi plus e1. Okay, and the second result clarifies the situation with goodness of these measures. This is the following condition. Again, we have this matrix A, we find eigenvector, and this matrix is determined by, this eigenvector and the measure is determined by the distinguished class which is responsible for the measure. You remember that we need to find the eigenvalue, the distinguished eigenvalue, and the submatrix just form this class alpha. And the following condition says that mu is good if and only if the other vertices or the other entries, after multiplication by an appropriate power of lambda, must belong to this group generated by the vertices, by the generators corresponding to the vertices of the distinguished class only. So in this form, it's a little bit more complicated. It's easier to see the following corollaries. So if we have rational values for the measure, then what this means, the above condition is the following. The measure is good if and only if the greatest common divisor of these numbers divides some power of lambda. If it happens that this just relatively prime numbers, then measure mu is always good. Okay, and from this result and from the previous one, it's easy follows the following equivalence. There is no difference between good, refinable, and weak refinable measures for measures from this class. These notions are equivalent. Examples. So, in this example, as I said, we have two. Subdiagram and these subdiagrams, they generate two meshes. It's easy to see that both these meshes are good, mu1 and mu2. But what is surprising that if you take this, any measure from the simplest generated by mu1 and mu2, these measures are not good. Well, the other example is the following. We consider the stationary diagrams where n is any number, any integer number, and we find conditions of n when such a diagram has good meshes. This only for these numbers where k is any. And let's see. This example on this diagram shows that the measure is not good. The measure determined by the previous example is not good. But if I erase just by one edge here, I have good measure. Or if I add one edge in this odometer, I have good measures. It's just the curious case. And let me formulate the last result. This about the class of the cardinality of the class of measures, which are homeomorphic to a given one. So this statement says that we can construct countably many diagrams, stationary diagrams, such that for every such diagram there exists a good measure, and all these measures are homeomorphic, homeomorphic to the fixed one measure which corresponds to B naught, but all these equivalence relations are not ordered equivalent. Actually, it's not hard to produce homeomorphic measure. You just apply a homeomorphism and you have a homeomorphic measure. But this example, this theorem shows that we consider just opposite case. We found homeomorphic measures which are not obtained by in such a trivial way by applying a homeomorphism. So, and moreover, the fact that they are not topologically orbit equivalent, not homeomorphic, because every diagram has the I has exactly I minimal components. And this theorem is proved in the following way. We start from a from a simple diagram, and we add minimal components, preserving the Kloppen value set for the measures. So we, as we know that these measures are good, and then they must be homeomorphic, but the fact that the number of minimal components is different says that they are not orbit equivalent. Okay, thank you. Let's stop.